Call the Joint House and Senate Education Committee in order, please. Thank you all for being here today. It's Monday, May 6, 2019. The time is 8:32, and in attendance are Senator Hughes, Senator Costello, and myself, Stevens. I'm sure others will be along shortly. Representative Drummond.
Good morning, Senator Stevens. Thank you. Present in House Education today, we have Representative Andy Story, Representative Delana Johnson, Representative Greyer Hopkins, and myself, Harriet Drummond. Oh, and Representative Rivak has joined us.
Hey, thank you for being here. So we have a quorum to conduct business. Today we have a presentation by the University of Alaska entitled Alaska's University for Alaska Schools, Teacher Preparation, Retention, and Recruitment Initiatives at the University of Alaska. This is a biannual report required by AS 1440-190B. Submitted on February 14th of 2019. This has been our first real opportunity to hold a hearing on this report. And we have Dr. Steve Atwater here with us. He's the Executive Dean of the UA College of Education to present this report. We also have Representative Zilkowski here with us. Okay, thank you all for being here. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Atwater. If you'd come forward, please, and put your name on the record for identification, please.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Steve Atwater. I'm the Executive Dean of the Alaska College of Education, and I'm here on behalf of the Board of Regents as well as President Johnson to review the Senate Bill 241 report that you have in front of you. And I'm also going to touch on some other issues with regard to the university and the larger context of teaching in Alaska. And I did want to mention it's graduation season, and so it's a really celebratory time for us here at the University of Alaska. And I know that a lot of us were at yesterday's event here in Juneau, so this is the culminating week for the school year. So it's a good time to be in front of you. So for today's presentation, I want to spend some time speaking with you about the teacher preparation programs that we offer at the University of Alaska. I want to see what we're doing since you last saw this report, what's different. I want to talk about the College of Education that's new. I want to talk about the recruitment efforts that we have that are new and different. Preparation, how that's an ongoing improvement, our retention efforts that we have, and then I do want to offer some program specifics. I've been asked to speak about the preparation of teachers for teaching reading. I'll touch on that, and then briefly I'll look ahead and see what's coming at us. As you know, the University of Alaska Anchorage will be discontinuing its initial licensure programs in September, and so I'll talk a little bit about what that means for the university system. So the pathway to become a teacher in Alaska is well established. The state, of course, is the licensing agency in terms of how you become a teacher, that you have to qualify through the state. And so there's basic pathways is to earn a bachelor's degree, or you can go through a program already with a bachelor's degree. All of them require an internship, a clinical component, where you're working inside of the school, and then you end up getting a job as a teacher. I want to note, have some people in our post-bac programs. Those are people who have already earned a bachelor's degree who are actually going to work right away without completing a program. The state does allow this. If you have a bachelor's degree and you have 5 years of experience in the content area in which you will be teaching, the state allows an initial license to be issued to those people, and occasionally that will happen. And so you'll see the need in school districts where there's unable to fill a vacancy. Instead of bringing in a student teacher or an intern, they'll actually hire that person because they're enrolled in a university program. So that is an option as a way to help meet some of the shortages that exist. And I would guess there's probably a dozen or so of those teachers out across the state.
Most Dr. Arfain, thanks very much. I appreciate those comments. Can you tell us about folks who have teaching certificates from other states? What's the opportunity of getting them into the classroom?
Yes, it's a basic situation where you apply to the state to get a certification, and if you've done the right preparation, you're eligible for a certificate. You do have to complete two courses, which is the Alaska Studies and the Multicultural course, to maintain that certificate, but it's a pretty basic position. If you have a certificate from another state, Alaska will accept it.
Thank you.
And so we have 19 different routes to becoming a teacher for your first time, and so lots of options for people to pursue at one of the three campuses in terms of how to do it. We have programs that are completely online. We have programs that are face-to-face, hybrid programs. And so students have a variety of ways in which they can pursue becoming a teacher. Some of the numbers that are inside of your report for you, you can see going across the top row are the numbers from the University of Alaska as a whole. And the average, of course, for those would be about 244. And those numbers are pretty steady overall. They haven't really gone as high as we'd like to see them go high, but they're also holding steady. And so that's an area that I'll talk about more, what we're doing to help improve that. But I did want to give you that perspective. And at the bottom, I did make a note, which is very interesting, is that there's an assumption that those of the people that are graduating with a teaching degree go to work. And that's not necessarily the case. And so the university's function is to prepare teachers. It's not to hire them, but it may be that people who are prepared to become a teacher don't choose to teach, or a family emergency or whatever happens, or they might be targeting a specific job. There might be a physics person in Fairbanks who wants to be the physics teacher at West Valley High School, and he's going to wait for that job to open. And so we do have situations where the number prepared doesn't equate to the number who go to work. And that's an important distinction, because when you look at these numbers, you would assume that all these people are going into the workforce, and it may not be the case. So I wanted to make sure you understood that.
Can you give us, some idea on how many students we're losing in that process, percentages or numbers?
It varies. It can be as high as 30% and as low as 10%. And again, it may be that they just choose not to work for a year. It may be that they are choosing not to work for 2 years. Or maybe they choose to go out of state. And we do have military families that are stationed out of state, of course, and so that might be the case for that.
Thank you.
But the next table just shows you the percentage of teachers that are hired each year that were prepared by the University of Alaska. And so you can see from these numbers, majority of teachers hired each year were not prepared by the University of Alaska. The numbers will be in the high 30s, low 40s, but overall, the state is dependent, and I'll talk about this some more, dependent on teachers prepared out of state, okay? And so underneath it, though, you can see the percent of the teachers working this morning, the number of teachers who went to work this morning is higher than the average number that's hired each year, because we know that Alaska prepared teachers stay in the state. And so about 42% of the teaching workforce in Alaska was prepared by the University of Alaska, okay? And our goal, of course, is to keep having that trend go up and make it higher. But the good news that we know is that our teachers that are prepared by the university do stay with their job a lot longer than those who were not. And I just said this piece for the slides, so we'll go there. Number one reason why teachers leave the
profession. Representative Starry?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Atwater. And I just wanted to say that I had the opportunity to go to graduation yesterday, and it was very moving. And I was wondering, when we're talking here about hiring our teachers, and I see later in the charts, and I can ask more questions then, of the ones that were placed and then the ones that are hired. And I'm wondering if the university, well, I know we don't guarantee placements, but I know many professions, we know all the students who are graduating are going to be hired when they, you know, walk across the stage. They've got jobs waiting, and it seems that is not happening in Alaska when we have so many vacancies. And I'm wondering if you could speak to why you think that is happening.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Story, thank you for that comment and question. And I do think the university plays a significant role with the placement of its graduates. You're probably familiar with Alaska teacher placement. The university has supported that for 30 years or so. That's hard dollars going to support the clearinghouse of teachers going into the field by the university. I think when teachers go into the field in terms of their clinical piece, their internship, their student teaching, those relationships that they forge with principals, they forge with the school districts are strong and lead immediately to hires. We had a great example of an Alaska Native teacher being hired in Kiana last week. He was up there doing his student teaching, and he got hired. And it's exactly what we're trying to do. And so I think we do have a lot of effort by faculty, by the local school districts with their relationships with the interns to make those hires. Certainly, if someone is doing an internship in Anchorage and chooses to work in Juneau, the connection may not be quite as strong, but I think there's enough. Our state is small enough where the relationships among the administrators are easily, achieved in terms of determining whether that's a good hire. Do we go out of our way to place people at large? Probably not as much as you might see in some of the other professions, but we do have school districts making presentations to our graduates. They're coming right into our classes and making presentations about what we're doing. I know that I used to do that as a superintendent. I would go and make presentations. This is what we're doing. And so it exists, but certainly it's an individual choice whether they choose to go, you know, where they're being recruited.
Could you help us while we're at this talk about how interns are assigned communities? And that might help us to understand that a little bit.
Yeah, and one of the slides, thank you, Chair Stevens, one of the slides is I'm going to show you the distribution of the interns.
You can wait till that point if you want.
Yeah, if you want to talk about that, yeah. Just to touch again that the Alaska Prepared Teachers do stay with us, so it's a good thing to have more of them. This graph here is just showing the number of unduplicated jobs, which are jobs that are filled by unique people. You will see numbers that are perhaps higher than this, and those are often the duplicated jobs. An example is a teacher who's hired to both teach health and teach PE. Those are considered by the department as two positions, but it may be one person fills that position. So an unduplicated job in this chart shows the number of people who were hired, and that's last year, or in 17, excuse me, was 500, and you can see that the number of UA teacher grads was probably 240 or so. And so what our challenge is to raise that lime green bar all the way up so that it meets the number of unduplicated jobs. And so that's the key for us, is to help get more people into the profession, recruit more people in. But you can see that our percentage of those hires varies depending on the year, but certainly is steady in terms of our numbers. And then just to provide some context, I've got a couple of slides here to give you some context with the big picture in K-12, and of course the university is tightly aligned with that. I don't know the number of vacancies. The state does a vacancy request survey the first day of the year, and that data is it's incomplete, so it hasn't been released, but certainly there's more than 100 jobs that are vacant at the start of the year. Last year, we looked at special ed jobs. There are almost 100 jobs that were not filled in special ed. So the vacancy rate in our state is as high as I believe it's ever been, and it's certainly an ongoing challenge for school districts across our state to try and fill their vacancies. And the next slide that I'm going to show you will help to illustrate why this is becoming harder and harder. And that is a study that was done, and this is the most recent national study that's been done with regard to number of teachers employed in the country and the number of teachers that are being prepared to, or number of people being prepared to teach. And you can see that overall there's about 3.3 million teachers in the United States. And in 15, you can see on the third bullet, 343,000 of them came into the system, but 531 went out. Okay, that's a problem. And if you look at the math there, it actually works out pretty nicely for those of us who do math in our heads. 343,000 of 3.3 million is roughly, what, 10%, okay? And so if we had a national 10% turnover, the amount coming into the system would replace that. So in many cases, when you think about the health of an organization, a 10% turnover is probably high. You probably want to have a little bit lower. 5% turnover is not bad. Organizational theory will help you, will let you know that you know, turnover does help an organization's health. So as a country, as a system, the number of people coming into the system is probably okay if we had a 10% turnover, but if you look at the 531, I think that's 16%. So what do? We got about 16% leaving the profession, but only 10% going in. And so we have this huge tension that now exists. And if you think back to the last slide that I showed you, or the earlier slide with the bar, you begin to understand that Alaska is dependent on the country for teachers, and this tension exists across the country for teachers being tugged in all directions because we don't have enough. And so it's more pronounced here, I think, than anywhere in terms of number of people being hired, because we depend on externally hired teachers more than any other state. And so that's the picture I'm trying to paint here, is that we as a state, we as a system, we as a university need to do everything we can to help address that. And so that's a huge challenge. And for our school districts, it's really difficult to find people. And almost always, the more pronounced examples come from rural Alaska. So what are we doing as a system? What is the University of Alaska doing as a system to respond to this? What's different? And so I'll touch on four different pieces here. One is the Alaska College of Education that was created just a year ago. Then I'll talk about the recruitment efforts that the university is doing in response to the need to get more people into the profession. Talk about what we're doing with regard to teacher preparation, how we're improving there to make sure that our teachers are as good as they possibly can be. Then I'll talk a little bit about supporting teacher retention. Teacher retention, of course, is not a university function. That's a K-12 function to support the retention of teachers, but the university does play a role, so I wanted to share some pieces with that. So the Alaska College of Education was put into place a year ago, and it was in response to having independent education units. We had a unit in Fairbanks, a unit in Anchorage, a unit here in Southeast at Juneau. So the issue is, what can we do differently as a way to coalesce our efforts with teacher preparation? And so the Board of Regents voted to create this Alaska College of Education as a way to have a single point of focus for various items and as a way to help provide a greater level of collaboration among the units. And so that's been going on since 18. And so why make that change to this college? And so each of the units was small, with a limited capacity to do a lot more. And the coordination among the three, although it was proposed and promoted, was never really probably as good as it might have been. And so the Regents took the step of creating this college as a way to establish a greater level of coordination among the units. And the other piece that the college allows to happen is a much tighter alignment with K-12. And because the college plays the single point of contact with the K-12 system in a way that the other units did not. By and large, the unit in Fairbanks has a really good, strong relationship with just a couple of school districts, Bering Strait, Lower Kuskokwim, Fairbanks, because that's where the majority of their work is. The UAA unit, mostly right there in South Central with Anchorage School District and Mat-Su. UAS is a kind of an oddity. UAS does not have an anchor school district. We don't have 80% of our people right here in Juneau. Our people from UAS are everywhere. And so the purpose of the Alaska College then is to be the single point for the entire state. Whereas the other units had very strong relationships with just a few districts, the college plays that role. And so my job as the executive dean is to play that tight relationship with the K-12 in a way that then exists, the single point of contact. That's an important distinction that never happened before, so I want to make sure that you understood that. So what changed? We still have three units, or did this year, and underneath, the Alaska College of Education provides a level of support, and I'll share some of the operations that it performs in a minute, and next slide. And you can see that my position as executive dean is sort of bifurcated in that I have traditional oversight of the unit here in Juneau at UAS. But I also am charged with the coordination of system-level activity. And so I work regularly with Vice President Lehr and the President's office in terms of what can we do as a system to help make improvements. And so that's a distinction that didn't exist before. I'm going to draw your attention to that.
Excuse me. I've got to say I misunderstood this reorganization, and I thought that all the units would be under the direct traditional oversight of yourself, and that changed along the way. Is that right?
Thank you.
Can you help us understand why that did, and if there's ever a chance of moving back to a more traditional one? I think of other states and other universities.
Chair Stevens, thank you for the question, and it's important to clarify. When the Regents did make the vote to create a single college of education, they did so with the intent that the entire system would be employed by that one college. Okay, that was the intent, that you would have a single. And the comparison that's easy to look at is the nursing model out of UAA. UAA is the only degree offering institution for nursing. What happened was that once they made the call to do that, is they looked at the accreditation from the university side. As you well know, each university needs to have its own accreditation. And the accrediting body, which is the Northwest Commission of Colleges and Universities, determined that what you're trying to do, while doable, is a heavy lift and will take several years to put into place, okay? Because the scale of what was being asked to do is different than nursing. It's much larger than nursing. The number of students involved is much larger than the number of students involved with nursing. So they recommended that you take time to put things in place in order to do that, or else face the likelihood that you would be jeopardizing your accreditation by putting all the students here at the University of Alaska Southeast. And so that's what happened. The intent of the region's vote, however, you're correct, was to have a single unit with all faculty employed by that unit, all students graduating from that single unit. Whether we can go there or whether that's the intent of the regents and the president to go there, I don't know. Certainly what's happened at the University of Alaska Anchorage with the discontinuation of the initial programs this year is now taking us down to two. And so, I think that's a complicated conversation that I'm not going to expand on much further than that. But certainly you are right that the intent initially was to do that.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
Yes, I find it fascinating, Dr. Atwood, what you just explained. Are you having conversations with the regions to see if they're thinking about going to one over a course of a few years? It seems like that is an important discussion to be having right now. And would you support doing that? Do you recommend doing that? And is it something that the Board of Regents will have on their agenda anytime soon?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, thank you for those questions. Those are difficult questions for me to answer. I'm not fully in a position to answer them. My opinion is that greater collaboration, greater coordination of the system is needed. Certainly, I think we would benefit as a system if we were able to do that. So I am supportive of doing that. Whether the regents are thinking in terms of bringing that forward again soon, I don't know. I know that there is an expectation that my position plays a deeper oversight than it may be designed to do. I have heard that from the regents, but I would defer that question to President Johnson and the regents. I'm not prepared to answer that. But I certainly do recognize the benefits of a system more tightly coalescing to do that.
Senator Hughes.
Mr. Chair, would that be possible to see what if the president is able to give us any idea of what he's thinking along those lines? He may not be prepared to do that, but considering the loss of accreditation and the UAA, I think it's a pivotal time.
Senator Hughes, that's a very important issue, and I believe Dr. Atwater was hired under the assumption that he would be, in fact, the traditional oversight over all the system, and I'm sorry that it's gone to this point, which seems to be less organized. So, absolutely, we will contact the president and the university and ask them if they can give us an update, when they can give us an update on what their plans are. Thank you very much. Thank you. Dr. Atwater.
So just briefly, what does the Alaska College do? What's different? We still have traditional oversight or traditional preparation programs. We do have a coordination role with the budgets of the different entities. We are the point for the data management and analysis for education data. That's new. That didn't exist before. That was performed by statewide and wasn't performed as a focus of statewide. So that's a real benefit that we have. We also lead with the recruiting for the system, and our recruiter, Dash Hildegarten, is here in the audience with us this morning. We are the main point of contact for the Department of Ed and Early Development. That's different. Instead of touching three, they touch one. The K-12 relations with education programs and associations, that's the single point of contact there. I work closely with Dr. Parity and her associations. We have a good relationship with regard to what's happening in K-12. As an example, I'm part of a meeting on Wednesday morning with superintendents from the South Central. So I'm engaged with the K-12 in a way that the system never had that level of engagement, certainly with policy, and then I'm the point of contact for the Board of Regents. And so the system is not redesigned as much as perhaps it was initially intended, but there has been several steps to make it much more efficient than it was with regard to external relationships. With regard to recruitment, I want to touch on what's happening out there with getting more people into the teaching programs, getting more teachers into the field. And the university recognizes that it's important for us to do as much as we possibly can to get more people to choose teaching. The first I'll touch on is a program that's called Educators Rising, and that is a national program that is now in more than half of the school districts. It's a program designed to steer high school students to the teaching profession. The University of Alaska established a career pathway for teaching, and that is now being implemented in high schools across Alaska. where students, and as part of their elective offerings at high school, are choosing to do this four-course career pathway. And that is leading in turn to people going on to college to become teachers. So that's a positive piece. And Educators Rising is supported by the president, the University of Alaska's budget, and is one that has, a good impact so far. So that's real positive. As I mentioned, we have a recruiter now that works.
Before we leave that issue of Educators Rising, I just want everyone at the table to know that Senator Hoffman, the chair of the subcommittee on education, put $850,000 into Educators Rising. I'd hope that you folks could support that when the budget comes to pass. And maybe you could help us understand how is that organization working, and how many districts do we have involved in that? Is it throughout the system? And what will this $850,000 be used for?
Thank you for the question, Chair Stevens. Money will be used primarily to expand Educators Rising to the middle school level. Right now it's a high school activity, and it will be used to create curriculum, to hire people to do that, and put it down into the middle school so that it's actually, instead of a 9-12 pathway, it becomes a 6-12 pathway. And so we're excited to do that. And it'll also be used to support outreach, as well as supporting districts, students who are participating in Educators Rising, as they do with other career pathways, participate in career technical events, and we bring them all together, and they compete with one another on a variety of issues, and actually go on to national competitions, national competition, which is next month in June, and that is one of the pieces that would be supported. And so it's an effort to expand what's there, to sort of blow it up another notch by going into the middle school, as well as to offering more outreach to support districts. Currently, there's 26 school districts that have participation. You'll see varying levels of participation. MATSU is one of the districts that's leading its engagement with Ed Rising. I know the Reddington High School is the high school that probably has the most engagement with Ed Rising right now. They're very active. Next year in Anchorage, Bartlett High School is going to be establishing a chapter. And so I know that across rural Alaska, it may not be in terms of numbers, but it's more widespread. It's more of a district-level activity as compared to a high school activity. In the big districts, it's more of a high school instead of a district, so I think that's an important distinction. But certainly there's hundreds and hundreds of students that are involved with this, and our hope is that if we can just nurture them well enough that they'll go right into the university system and enroll in teacher preparation programs.
So, yes, Representative, please go ahead.
If you have a question, please go first.
Well, I was going to ask, I'm giving away my decades and decades ago when I was in high school, I wasn't involved in Future Teachers of America, but that was an organization there. Is this similar to that, or is there a different approach that's being taken with Educators Rising?
Yeah,
it just seems a little more involved.
It is, and you may remember there was a Future Educators of Alaska, and that was a program that existed for years and really had very poor return. It didn't lead to a lot of teachers, new teachers, and it was primarily an after-school activity where students came together, and really it didn't have enough depth to it. So what we did is to create a career pathway that I described, so the students are actually giving up the option to take music or take art or whatever their elective is, woodshop, and instead choosing to do a career pathway in teaching. And so it's an engagement at the students' level, a decision. It's not an after-school club decision inside of your classes to engage at the level. So I think that's the difference, is that the students are having a lot more buy-in and they're vested in it. And I believe that the teachers are, and we, that's part of the preparation that we have to offer, which is part of the money you mentioned, is to prepare the teachers to work in that pathway, are actually engaged at a different level than an after-school type activity coordinator. It's one of their teaching responsibilities.
Thank you. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Chair Stevens. With the Educators Rising, there was one of the competitions down here a few months ago, and there was a few of us on this committee that attended it. I believe there was 85 students there at that state. I guess it was more of a show than the actual competitions that had already happened. How long has Educators Rising been going on, and is there any data that we're tracking to follow its effectiveness, and how many of those students do actually go into the UA School of Education?
Yeah, this is, through the chair, Representative Hopkins, this is just the second year of Educators Rising being implemented. And so we are seeing graduates go into the field, but it would be premature to say that they're on their way. As you know, a freshman in college, that's early. Mm-hmm. You know, what we're really worried about is when they come out the other end. And so we are tracking it very closely. We do have the identifiers to the students so that we can see where they are inside of our system, and we will be tracking that. So I would hope I would report back to you in a couple of years that it's leading to the placement of, you know, 100 student teachers that were former Educators Rising students. Yeah.
Thank you. Please go ahead, President Hawkins.
Thanks, Senator. That educator student, or that Educators Rising, you'd mentioned the Alaska Teacher Placement Program, and in a few slides you have mentioned about teacher mentors. How, and those are all housed in the K-12 Outreach Office up at Mutrovich and Fairbanks at statewide. How does the College of Education coordinate with that K-12 Outreach Office?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hopkins, yes, I'm in regular contact with that office. In my previous job, which ended last year, I was actually had oversight of that office, and so I'm sort of well-positioned to maintain that relationship. So we're constantly working together, and obviously the money that comes from the university is put toward the Educators Rising comes with my blessing, and so I think that's an important piece to note.
So it's not housed under the College of Education, it's somewhere else? Is it at statewide? Is it where is
the K-12 Outreach Office actually belongs to the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Okay.
Yeah, and so the people that work there are employed by the University UAF, but they perform a state-level function, and so their duty is not a Fairbanks duty, it's a state-level function. And if you look at the activity inside of that, that occurs in that office, it's all across, mm-hmm. across the state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Story.
Thank you. I'm trying to get a picture of if the new Educator Rising curriculum is a dual credit class, is an elective that students get, is it an elective that builds upon one another, so you take a beginning, Educators Rising, and a second?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Story, it is not a dual credit. There's a lot of interest in whether or not we should do dual credit. And I'll birdwalk here for a second and offer that, in my mind, the most important dual credit the high school students can earn are those GERs, particularly in math and English. If you can knock those off as a high school student, writing 111, math 151, you show up at UA as a freshman, you got those behind you, far more important than having introduction to education. Okay, that's what I preach constantly to the K-12 environment. While there's a keen interest in these credit in these classes serving that purpose, they don't currently. There's no reason why we can't go there, and there's, I think we will. I think that's a piece that we will. So I see that happening. Can you take the courses out of sequence? You can. They are standalone courses, but they're designed to take in sequence. And so it would be okay if students dropped in and did the third course first, but it's actually the overall design is preferred that you go A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello?
Yes, please.
So 1, 2, 3, 4, does that mean it's a two-year program?
It is, yeah.
So half a credit
is. Each course is a semester, yep.
Semester.
And so, yep.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
I spoke about the recruiter, the partnerships I've mentioned. One of the efforts that the university is working with school district is to help paraprofessionals become teachers. And there's no one better to become a teacher than a paraprofessional, right? I mean, they are in the schools, they understand the community, they know the ins and outs of all the pieces and are, in many cases, the most constant piece of a school or school district. And so we are working with districts across the state, primarily Lower Kuskokwim with UAF and St. Mary's with UAS, to help those paraprofessionals earn their certificate. And as you can imagine, it's a slow process. Many of these people are only able to take one or two courses per semester. And so to get all the way through the system, it takes a while. As an example, UAF is graduating about 2 to 3 paraprofessionals from Lower Kuskokwim each year. And these are obviously local people who are the school districts invested in, who are going to go straight to work in their home communities, which is good.
Maybe you'd help us understand that a little bit more. I'm familiar with several teaching assistants who in small villages who, when you see them operating, you realize they could be great teachers. And as I'm sure that's the folks you're talking about. But the problem for many of them is they live there, they have a family, they can't give it away for a few years at the university. How can they be helped to move forward and become teachers?
Yeah, I think the model that Lower Kuskokwim employs is really the ultimate way to do it. And what they do is recognize that those paraprofessionals that are far enough along in earning their teaching credential, their final year, they pay them the salary as if they were working. But they don't work. They just become and do their internship. And so Lower Cuscom is actually investing hard dollars into this process, recognizing that we're going to pay you to actually go to school or do student teaching. Many of the paraprofessionals, as you probably can imagine, are mothers with children at home and don't have the freedom to simply stop working. And so that's the model that we have to get to. Unfortunately, our smallest school districts don't have those sort of hard dollars available. And so it's a difficult model to emulate at all districts. But that is a good way to go, to figure out a way to somehow support the people so that they can step back from their teaching or from their job duties and just focus on their preparation duties.
Thank you. Representative Zapasti.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, Mr. Atwater, but just a comment. I had the opportunity to meet with one of the paraprofessional educators that's currently moving through the process in the Lower Kuskokwim School District recently on a visit that he had here to Juneau, and you mentioned that it's a slow process and that it's not churning out significant numbers of teachers, but what it is churning out are paraprofessionals and educators who will likely retire from those school systems as educators. It was really incredible to see the investment that this individual had in the particular school that he's in. He knows the students, he knows the school systems, he knows the school board members. And so while it might be somewhat slow in terms of meeting this significant need and in terms of having the volume of impact that we might need, it absolutely is a worthwhile investment. And seeing the passion and the commitment that this individual had and the knowledge that he had from on the ground was quite inspirational.
Thank you. Representative Story.
Yes, I can imagine that paraprofessionals who have been in the system for many years have great expertise in behavior management, issues like that, which oftentimes when are some of our newer teachers, that's one of the greatest skills to develop in being an effective teacher. And then, of course, there's the course content and how to teach reading well and those kind of academic pursuits that are very needed. I'm wondering, though, if someone can, is there a competency test to take in certain, disciplines? Has the university considered that in an opportunity to move along those who seem to show the academic knowledge as well as have the hands-on behavior management pieces to move forward quickly or in the system?
Yeah, that's through the chair, Representative Story, that's a good question because there's a constant sort of push or nudge to use prior experience, prior knowledge to qualify for a course and not have to take it, okay? And so the university does allow up to 25% of a degree to be earned that way, where you're showing proficiency or competency in an area and therefore not having to take the class. And so I'm not aware that that's being done with any of the education classes, but certainly someone could petition it, and there's no reason why we couldn't do more that way to do that.
Thank you. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How do in the Lower Kuskokwim School District, without leaving their home communities, how do such paraprofessionals take the classes that are required to move them towards a degree?
Yeah, these are distance courses that they take, and then in May, right now, or right after school is out, UAF brings a group of them into Bethel where they do an intensive 2 weeks of courses to get maybe two classes out of the way. So that's one of the ways that they could lick them. They also come to campus in Fairbanks to take classes that way in the summertime. But primarily during the winter, it is distance. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Well, it's really great to hear about that program, and I think we need to spend some time, maybe next year or sometime, hearing from that district and what they're doing and how others may emulate that. For the questions?
And as Representative Zolkowski said, it's really what we're after. It's local people getting local jobs, and they're not going to disappear. And so that's exactly what we're after. So,
right.
Yeah. And finally, my final bullet is one that I regularly speak to, and that is not a university responsibility, but it's all of our responsibility, and that is, how do you raise the social esteem of the teaching profession? What do we do as a state to make teaching attractive socially so that more people are drawn to it? Okay, and there's lots of examples from other places, and I hate to point to Finland because everyone shrugs their shoulders when you use Finland because it's enough already with Finland. But certainly the social esteem of a teacher in Finland is very different from here. And so what do we do as a state to help raise that esteem so that more of our young graduates from high school, from college, are interested in the profession? So I just call on all of us that have an ability to affect this conversation to do what we can to help raise that esteem. because right now we have vacancies and our children are often being put into situations where a teacher is supervising two classes or perhaps someone who's not fully prepared is teaching, and so we need to avoid that if we can.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. This just makes me want to pause and say this is the beginning of National Teacher Appreciation Week, this whole week, the 6th through the 10th. And so certainly I think our teachers are unsung heroes, and I really appreciate this bulletin, this point in here. And I think one thing we can do as policymakers, it is really important that we are looking at, as one of our charges is to maintain a system of public schools, and here is that we do in our funding, and we know that funding is not everything, but funding matters, and certainly for the profession, and that we do have a dependable system where we, and I know where this body has been really working towards that the last couple of years, so we're not giving out pink slips and things like that, and I really appreciate that intent of this body, and I hope we will continue diligently to work on that.
Thank you.
So that's regard to recruitment. With regard to preparing teachers, what are we doing as a system to ensure that our teachers are as good as they possibly can be? There's a lot of evidence that our UA prepared teachers, as I mentioned, stay in the profession in Alaska longer than those that were not prepared here. And so I think that what we do as well as, which is so important, is understand the local context with instruction. Our students that are prepared to be teachers are given a lot of examples, a lot of training, a lot of stress on using the local context to drive their instruction. This is often called place-based teaching, where they're using the local context. And so that's a key piece, because if students are able to apply what they're being taught locally, then it's going to make a lot more sense. Often, students are asked to learn concepts through a textbook, and if the textbook is offering an example or an illustration that is foreign or different to them, then it may not resonate, it may not make sense. An example that you might think of that's easy to understand is the idea of density, teaching the concept of density to middle school students in science. And how do you teach that? What does density mean? And we all know the formula, you know, mass divided by volume, but how do you get that through to a 13-year-old, a 12-year-old? Mm-hmm. On a textbook, you might be looking at a diagram of a bunch of molecules that are tightly compressed and those that aren't, okay? A local application of that might be to go outside the school and dig a snow pit and look at the various layers of snow and show the different density according to the layer. Okay, that's an example that we teach our students to use as a way to get those concepts across. And so I think that's an advantage that our UA prepared teachers have that someone who's prepared out of state probably doesn't have, which is what we stress. We also have a tighter relationship with K-12, as I said, in terms of making sure that we're doing what we can to prepare our people to work in the K-12 environment. There's not a disconnect, and so I believe that's an improvement. The internship experience that our people have is better than it ever was. We're spending more time than we ever have with the host teachers, the mentor teachers that work with our interns. We have a much tighter way of supervising and providing evaluation of our interns. So overall, we're constantly making improvements with the preparation, and I believe are putting out stronger teachers. Another example is preparing teachers to work in a multi-graded classroom. Many of our schools across Alaska have multi-graded classrooms. If you show up from Ohio and you have no idea what that means, and you're asked to teach third, fourth, and fifth grade in a smaller community, then it takes a lot of learning for how to do that. And so we emphasize that as well.
Thank you, Representative Story.
Yes, a couple things. One, I had meant to share earlier, but just wanted to share with this group that I'm on, I have the pleasure of serving on UAS's External Advisory Council, and I find that I've only been able to be to one meeting, but the improved relationships with K-12 to help drive improvement efforts, I think is just critical that the university is doing, and I am wondering, since we know about a third of, I don't know how many districts use MAPS, Measured Academic Progress, and that we have Ames Web, different things that drive assessment. Are the students trained in the assessment tools that the majority of our districts are using? Because we know assessments need to be informed in real time. PEAKS has its place, but I know our districts are trying to respond to the students' instructional needs right now and be able to turn very quickly. So I'm wondering on that level with assessments if they're being trained in those so they're ready to go. And then I, and you might address this later, like reading strategies. I don't know if the university knows all the different reading curriculums that are being used in the state, having to do math, science too, and are they making sure the teachers are familiar with the ones that are being used the most?
Through the chair, Representative Story, thank you for that comment. And what you raise is a very interesting challenge for a university, and that is whether or not the preparation program should be expected to expose or train teachers in specific programs. Okay, and as you know, those programs vary, and there are a lot of them. And so it's the university's position that they should not solely train a teacher, a future teacher in a program. However, they should prepare them well to use the program. During their internship, they necessarily are exposed and will be using a specific program. But the university is not going to adopt that we are going to use the Houghton Mifflin reading program in our preparation series. Okay, that can't be our approach, because that's only used with 3 or 4 or maybe 10 districts in the state. We can't take that level of specificity. Your other question is broader, where the majority of the districts in Alaska do use the MAPS assessment, and we are introducing our candidates to that assessment. We do have assessment classes where they understand assessment and are learned how to use it. But it does raise a good point, so thank you for bringing that up. And that is, there's sort of a tension that exists, and if that's fair, that the K-12 expects that the teachers are prepared to do exactly what they're doing in their school district, okay? But that's probably not fair to do that because of the variety of, and the variance that exists across the system for that purpose. An example with MAPS, though, certainly that is fair, that we, because it's so widespread at this point.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
What I hear you saying is that if there is something that is widespread in the state, that one of the reasons for the close linkages is that the university would look to making sure they're educated in that. Like, I think social emotional learning and adverse childhood experiences, it seems like you are moving to making sure your teachers.
Yeah, I have some. Yeah, through the chair, Representative, I have some slides on that that very example, and I'll touch on that. But certainly, first is understanding the bigger concept and how to apply it, and then the specificity of a program would follow. But if it's not broad enough, it would be wrong for the university to embrace a certain program, a certain reading program. But the training for how to use the bigger picture is certainly being put in place.
Thank you. Please continue.
And then I just want to, in terms of how do we improve, give you a quick slide on the accreditation process that we're required to go through. And this has got a fair amount of attention because of UAA this last couple, 3 months. But I did want to make the point that the accreditation system is based on a quality assurance system, and that is new for the education units to base their accreditation on quality assurance. Obviously, in private industry, quality assurance is the basis of what you do. You go out of business if you don't have quality assurance. But for the university, for the education units, we didn't ever have to do this at this level before. So the new accreditation system that we have to comply with requires a quality assurance system that is comprehensive across the entire unit. The other bubbles outside of the central bubble there are the different standards that we have to meet, and I can speak to any of those if you want. But I did want to stress that that we are in a state of continuous improvement driven by quality assurance systems. And as an example, what we found with our graduates is that they are struggling to work with students for whom English is not their first language, English language learners. Our graduates, we're learning now that we're not doing enough in that area, that we need to do more. Okay, and so what we're doing in response to that is determining whether or not we need to actually have separate classes in ELL. Do we need to put that inside of our existing classes, our existing courses, to help ensure that our candidates are getting what they need in terms of working with the ELL students? And then this afternoon, just as to follow up on that example, at UAS, we are holding our first meeting in response to this. We are talking as a full faculty to determine whether or not we want to begin to look at ELL as a separate course that would go across the various programs or fuse it inside of the existing courses. And so This is a key distinction in terms of how we're doing business and how we're improving ourselves that we didn't used to do. Certainly, there was a lot of internal program level coordination that was ongoing, but this unit, full unit coordination that's in response to the CAPE accreditation has been real positive for us in terms of helping us to improve. I did share that we serve the state, and this slide, it's kind of hard to see. I apologize. It's got some numbers. These are interns that are in the field today, and you can see that the majority are bunched where the people live, South Central Alaska, but we do have people across the state that are having experience in schools. So I wanted to share that those students are out there in the field and having a variety of experience. We also offer what's called a rural practicum, where students that are doing internships in some of the bigger areas, the road system districts, are able to go out and spend 2 weeks in a village, working at a village school or observing that. And so that's a great introduction to what it's like to be in rural Alaska. You may not have to dedicate your full semester or full year of intern placement, but we do support students to go out and have a two-week exposure or experience working on the North Slope or in Northwest Arctic or wherever. That's real positive. And the report Appendix D does show you in detail the names of the buildings or communities where the interns are placed. So how do we know that we're doing well? Certainly, we get feedback regularly from K-12 with regard to what we're doing. We survey principals after a teacher is hired. The following spring, right now, we survey the principal and say, how did he or she do? And that's incredibly powerful feedback. And that is a survey that the whole system does or use a nationally normed survey, so that's been real positive. Inside of CAPE, that accreditation that I just showed you, the illustration, one of the standards, standard 4.1, asks us to demonstrate the impact of our graduates on the learning. Are they making a difference? Are the kids learning? Very difficult task. As you know, there's a lot of variables that affect student learning, but we're being asked to show that, you know, Susan graduated, she's teaching fourth grade. Are those students responding to that? Are they learning? And so we are putting together cohorts of our grads and speaking to them closely. We're looking at their MAPS results. Representative Story just mentioned the MAPS test and determining whether or not we're actually making a difference. So that's a way that we determine whether we're going. And then finally, the anecdotes that we get, that the qualitative feedback that we get with regard to hiring, that UA-prepared teachers are doing well, they're having good success, is how we know that we're doing well. Certainly, we are in a constant state of improvement. We don't feel that we've ever arrived, but we do feel that the feedback overall is very positive. Switching now to retention, and I give you this slide as some context, and this is not a university issue necessarily or directly. Indirectly, of course, it is. But this shows you the number of non-tenured teachers, the percent of non-tenured teachers in school districts. As you know, you earn tenure the first day of your fourth year of employment. And so if you look at the percentages, and those teachers, those percents are teachers that have worked in that district less than 3 years. Okay? And so when you look at the challenge of retention, that indicates that the churn, the people coming and going, is high, and the impact on the recruitment, the efforts, all the pieces that go with it are ongoing. And so that is for us is a key piece why we want to, as a university, support the retention of teachers, because we need that number to come down and be lower as we can. And so obviously the larger districts have a more stable workforce, but we certainly want to support all of Alaskan teachers in terms of staying in the position.
Representative Lukowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually just sent a note for some follow-up from the university, but since this is somewhat of an appropriate time to ask this question, I would be interested to know if a little bit more, all of the teaching preparation programs that are highlighted on page 15, it would be interesting to see what the retention rate of teachers coming out of those programs are, in better understanding how we are potentially impacting or moving the needle as it relates to the items on this particular slide.
through the chair, Representative Sokolsky, good question. I've not disaggregated the by program like that. I think that would be really interesting to do. And I could suspect, I'm going to guess, that the those that are going through a post-bac program are more likely to stay and be stable for a variety of reasons. They're not 23 years old. They're often 30 years old. They're at a different point in their life. They've earned a bachelor's degree. Now they've earned a teaching certificate. And they're invested in the career probably a little bit more heavily. That's my suspicion. I've not looked at that, but I would suspect that that would be the case.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
If and when the university does do an analysis of those rates by program, I would love to see them.
I get it.
Thank you. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dean Atwater. If you'd remind us how tenure works, if tenure is not achieved, say, in the lower Yukon school district, and that teacher goes to another district, do they start all over again in terms of the 3 years and
they
one
do.
Day of employment?
Yeah. Tenure is not portable, but you are, if you're tenured in another district, you can come to a new district, teach for a year, and then get it the first day of your second year. So it is portable after a year. Okay. But no, if you do 2 years, and you're just in a cycle of around and round. So. So I just included this just to provide some context to the need for the retention. Retention
question from Representative Hawkins.
I'm sorry.
More a statement, just so the committee knows the teacher's tenure and if they are retained or not retained at the end of the year, it has nothing to do with their performance that year. It's not based on evaluations. It's not based on the teacher's performance or the student's performance. It's based on often budgetary reasons, relationship with the supervisors or the principals or the school district. And many, many, many different things, or the town that they live in. So these statistics in terms of Lower Yukon and Northwest Arctic are probably going to be fairly consistent across the many of our rural districts, and those are first three-year teachers. So if we have Lower Yukon and majority of our teachers in that district are in their first 3 years of teaching, that is when, after those first 3 years, that they start becoming much more skilled educators. And having this system where they are not based on performance and not based on the students learning or anything like that, and we continue to see this turnover before the teachers even have the ability to become good teachers, is a strong problem because it's essentially a three-year probationary period, which is far longer than any other job that I know, especially in the private sector. And once you retain tenure, there's a false narrative that you can't fire that teacher, that they're stuck in that job, and that is certainly not true. Then it is actually based on performance. If a teacher is their performance is not adequate, then you can terminate that teacher at any time. But these 60% and 50% of these teachers in Lower K and Northwest Arctic, they could be excellent teachers and they could be non-retained at the end of their 3 years because a lot of districts end up cycling their teachers out at that time. So it's an unfortunate cycle and something we probably could address to give these beginning of the career teachers more stability in their job by giving them more mentorship programs, by assisting them in those first 3 years when the need is the highest. So this is an interesting fact that is not unique to many, many districts across the state.
Thank you.
And so as I said earlier, the function of supporting teachers in the field in K-12 is really not a university function. I mean, that's a K-12 works very hard to help the teachers stay and offer support for them. But the university does offer support through the Alaska Statewide Mentoring Project. Currently, we're working with 158 early career teachers in 21 school districts. That's hard dollars from the university to make that happen in part. And so we recognize as a university that it's really important for our state, for all of our students in our state, for our teachers to be well-trained and to stay and to be retained. The churn of teachers in schools and school districts is detrimental to students and their achievement, and so we want to make sure that we can, as a university, support as best we can. And then we also have professional development support for teachers, for the new teachers that we offer. So I wanted to make sure you're aware of that. That's what we're doing in response to the challenge of preparing more teachers. I'm going to switch gears right now and speak about more specificity. I was asked to speak about working with struggling readers. I know there was a lot of interest that came out of the task force on reading and dyslexia, and so just to run through these bullets, system does prepare teachers to teach reading, as Representative Story suggested, but we do not prepare teachers to teach a specific program tied to reading. They're taught how to assess readings to determine the source of the struggles and to respond instructionally. That's a key piece. We are, all of our graduates have a close, or take courses in special education. They understand how to identify a disability, how to look to address that disability, and as necessary to refer, if appropriate, for special education services. So if a reader is struggling, or a student is struggling to learn how to read, certainly our teachers are prepared or trained with how to do that or how to respond. And then the H. Bill 64 has caused us to take a hard look at ourselves, which has been really positive. I know that we've, in turn, done a lot of reflection with whether or not we're doing everything we can to support struggling readers. And I know that we're expanding some of the courses and supplementing them with extra focus on dyslexia. We do have courses that are expanded now to have a greater emphasis on how to recognize that and help students who suffer from that.
Thank you. Thank you, Dean Atwater. That's gratifying to know that House Bill 64 has caused the university to take a good close look. One of the things we learned during those task force sessions was that there are roughly 8 schools of education in the country that Alaska tends to hire from, but only 2 of them, I think it's University of Washington, and I think the other one is somewhere in the northern Midwest, teach the science of reading the way it's been recommended to us to be able to handle dyslexia and other reading disabilities. And I'm glad to hear that you're not teaching to a specific curriculum. That doesn't make sense. But to teach the science of reading, mm-hmm. Which has not been done before in our schools, and I'm glad to hear you're moving in that direction. Truly glad.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Story.
Yes. So how would you describe that the University of Alaska teaches reading, the science of reading? What does that mean to the University of Alaska?
Yeah, and I can speak this deep. I can't go as far as the professors can go, but I know that the foundations of literacy courses that are required part of our programs do touch on the 5 components of reading, the science of reading, and they are learned that. So I think they learn how to. I know they learn how to assess readers and determine where they are. I think one of the key distinctions that we want to make sure that we have is that people learn to read in different ways. And I know that all of us who are parents have experience with children how they acquire their literacy. And there is not just one way to do it. It would be wrong to simply say that all of our students would have to be taught in a single way. And so one of the focuses that we put on it with our teacher preparation is to help determine what is the best way to teach that student who's acquiring his literacy. If a student is often running, it doesn't make sense to force them to go back and learn phonemes. They're down, and they've made those mental connections already. And likewise, if a student's struggling to learn to read, going back, stressing the phonetic instruction is obviously very important, and we would do that. So I would say that our teachers, our candidates, are prepared to teach reading from an assessment perspective. They know how to determine where a student is with their acquisition of reading. And then they also are based in the foundations of literacy with the 5 areas of reading. With that said, it's important to note, and this is one of those program at a school level, when a teacher shows up in a school district, they are told how to teach reading, and they are given a program for how that works, and asked with to be in compliance with that. And so our piece is a foundational piece that sits underneath that to help guide the implementation of that program. But again, we do not teach that specific program.
Thank you. Please continue.
And then the next slide is just some more about responding to the input of reading, and I've touched on a lot of this already, but I did want to just follow up on Representative Drummond's point that the task force did bring the university together as a unit to analyze where we are with teaching reading, and I believe it's been a really positive outcome. I know there was some pending legislation which I don't believe is going to go forward at this point, but certainly we're very interested in affecting that conversation if we can. Next, I want to move on to one of the areas that is really dear to us because it's becoming more and more prevalent, and that is preparing our teachers to work with students who have experienced trauma. You've probably seen the statistic that is in the first bullet, and the adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, is now, I would say, more pronounced than it's ever been. In our feedback that Representative Story just mentioned from the External Advisory Committee, our teachers on that committee are telling us that they now are working with 3 to 4 students in a classroom who are exhibiting symptoms of ACEs and in comparison to maybe 1 or 2 in the past. And so the level of detail, or no, excuse me, the number of students experience ACEs appears to be on the rise, and certainly it's more and more of a challenge for our classroom teachers to work with children. Once upon a time, when a child was having a very difficult time, often was given an FBA, which is a functional behavior assessment. The student's having a very difficult time, FBA, and that started a referral process into the special ed, or certainly a behavior modification plan or some sort of plan like that. Now the numbers are high enough where that's not a practical response to that. There are just too many of students. So we recognize as a system we need to do everything we can to help prepare our teachers to work with children who experience trauma. One of the bases of working with children who have experienced trauma is the relationship, is developing a strong relationship with the child so that they do have a sense of peace, a sense of ease with working with the teacher. And so throughout our programs, we do stress the need to have a strong relationship with the students, with the child, and we feel that that's good and certainly the basis. Once they show up in the school district, then the district is often has a social-emotional learning type program. They have a practice that they'll implement. We are not teaching necessarily all those different programs, but that's usually a district level or sometimes a school level response to how to approach it. So we do stress the need to work with children with ACEs, and certainly building the strong relationships is the key for how to do that. Very difficult challenge. And it would be, I was actually very surprised by our teachers who were in our external advisory committee the other day when they responded back to us about this is our reality, is that this is not what it was 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that I think we need to make sure. And what it's lending itself to is there a need to have more behavioral type health support systems inside of our school buildings? And I know that's a complicated conversation that is not appropriate right now, but certainly where I see this going is the College of Health at the University of Alaska Anchorage, College of Education, sort of merging pathways in a way because of the support services that are required for so many students. That's a conversation that I'm having with Dean Jesse at UAA, but certainly it's a challenge for school districts and how to address that. So I did want to make that point that we do stress it, that this is a reality, and certainly our interns face that. And then I want to close here just with opportunity for you to ask questions if needed. As you know, the regents voted on April 8th to discontinue the 7 initial licensure programs at UAA. And so those are phased out effective September 1. UAF and UAS are asked to assume responsibility for those programs for those students. It's a complicated transition that's in full swing right now. I'm one of the main people coordinating that transition. The goal is that the students would be unharmed, that they would have opportunities across the system as they do before. And so we will have a physical presence on the UAA campus in terms of offering services to those students. But basically, I wanted to, if necessary, address this. I didn't know if you want to ask questions regarding this, but I'm receptive to that if needed.
Well, thank you, Dr. Edwards. It's a very important question, and one that has a great concern here in the legislature. So maybe help us to understand, how would that actually work? You would use the same faculty that is now teaching in Anchorage, but they would be actually working for you or Fairbanks. So help us to understand how practically that will work for the students.
Yeah, UAF and UAS would employ faculty, Anchorage-based faculty, and would offer courses face-to-face as well as online. But the experience that students are having now in Anchorage, our job is, or our goal is to replicate that, but it would be with faculty that are employed from a different university. And the example that is easy to point to is if you were at the graduation yesterday, we had nursing students graduate, and they were wearing UAA regalia here in Juneau, okay? And so So that's the way that we would approach that, is that the students would go through the system at UAA but would be earning a degree from S or F, so to speak.
So the loss of accreditation in Anchorage had nothing to do with the faculty or the quality of the faculty. It was other issues.
No, I think the loss of accreditation, if you go back to my slide with the bubbles, was primarily due to, this is Steve speaking, was primarily due to the lack of a quality assurance system. That the unit had not gotten to the point where they had a quality assurance system that convinced the reviewers that they were at a point that they were using feedback to get better. I think the individual faculty, it wasn't a rating on them at all. It was a rating on the system as a whole. It wasn't a rating on a specific program, on an early childhood program. That wasn't what it was, how the system coordinates and works together. And it was deemed it wasn't doing a very good job in that quality assurance in terms of how is it going to improve.
I realize this all came at a time where we were looking at a governor's budget of a substantial decrease in funding, and I know the cost of accreditation, of moving towards accreditation, would be expensive in Anchorage, but it just seems to me that it's tough for a major university not to have an accredited, the largest campus, the largest number of students, not to have an accredited program. So is the, and this may not be in your bailiwick, but do you think it is the goal of the regions to eventually re-accredit the university in Anchorage or not?
At this point, I don't believe it is the goal. I believe the goal is to establish the other two in place. It could well be that the number of students is at a point where it makes sense, but I like the other question I received earlier from Senator Hughes, I'm not prepared to answer that. I don't have that vision with regard to the regions. So.
I understand. Any different questions on that issue? It's one that has our attention certainly. Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dean Atwater, it's my understanding that the Anchorage unit was the only one that had early childhood training. Is that now gone from Anchorage, and does it exist in the UAS and UAF systems in order to be provided to our largest community?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Drummond. The Bachelor of Arts in Early Childhood does no longer exist after September 1. The system will not offer a Bachelor of Arts in Early Childhood. In order to secure a license to teach early childhood, you need to have a minor in early childhood, a Bachelor of Arts in Elementary Education with a minor in early childhood education. You go to the Department of Education, they'll issue you a license to do that. That pathway exists and will continue to exist. Whether a Bachelor of Arts in Early Childhood Elementary is reestablished, maybe, I don't know. We're certainly taking a hard look at that, and there's really no reason why we couldn't eventually go there. But for next year, there will not be a Bachelor of Arts in Early Childhood Elementary. There will be a clean pathway through University of Alaska Fairbanks to get that early childhood endorsement on top of the license. So if you're interested in teaching preschool in Alaska, that option, that pathway is very much still alive and there. But the Bachelor of Arts in Early Childhood Elementary Education will not be present next year. I could well see that being reestablished, however, or for UAF or UAS to take that on. And so, but a good question, because a lot of students are inside of that program. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Story.
Yes, in the appendix on page 15, 16, and 17, having to do with the programs, from information I've heard before, I think that this chart hasn't been updated since UAA. Since there's been changes to the system?
Right. This report was prepared in November and then slightly amended in February in response. But you're absolutely right. This is lagging information at this point. It's not leading. No.
Thank you.
Thank you for the questions, for the comments. Anything further you'd care to present to us, Dr. Atwater?
No, just thank you for having me. And I know that on behalf of the Regents, I wanted to share that the university has two workforce priorities. One is in the area of health, the other is in the area of teacher education or teachers. And so in times of budget challenges, the university has continued to support teacher education at a high level. And so I wanted to just note that the university does treat the preparation of teachers as a top priority in the in terms of workforce, and will continue to do so. And our goal is to continue to recruit more people into the system and to prepare UA teachers ultimately, if it works, the number of UA prepared teachers will be high enough that the retention will be high enough where that the number that's needed to replace them will keep shrinking downward. That's the goal. And so this large number of teachers that come into the system each year is challenging, is daunting for the system to replicate that. It would be really hard for us to suddenly bounce up to 800 teachers a year, okay? But if we can get the need or the turnover down low enough where the state only needs 300 to 400 teachers a year, that's a very doable number that we can strive to achieve. Right now, like I said, the average is about 250 a year, 244 or so. So that's our challenge is to get that. And anything you can do, as I mentioned, to help with raising that social esteem of teaching, that is really needed so that when you're 19 years old, you're trying to decide what it is I want to do with my life, that's a job, a profession that's highly valued by our society, and one that's going to be rewarding and one I want to pursue. So with that, I'll stop.
Thank you, Dr. Atwater. We have a few questions. Representative Story, Representative Hopkins, and Senator Hughes.
Yeah, and just a quick comment based on what you just said about retaining teachers. We did have an excellent report by ICER, and they had some suggestions outside of, you know, salaries and benefits of good things to do, teacher housing, just things that you're talking about. So I'm so glad to hear that. And, but I wanted to draw attention to page 24, and I guess I probably do need to hear more about our Alaska teacher placement process, because on page 24, I see we have 197 interns, and 20 were placed in the spring. And I'm not sure if I'm reading this right, but it seems like we have, are these interns ready to be hired in the system?
Yeah, these are ones that finished yesterday.
Okay, and so basically we have a lot of teachers out there looking for jobs.
Yeah, these are all people who are now eligible to receive a license to teach, and whether they, as I said, whether they choose to pursue to work, that varies by the individual, but certainly yes. Mm-hmm. And we have lots of good success stories. Had a nice graduate here at UAS who is working at Bethel High School, who's just got a job, very exciting. And so we have a lot of good success stories, but certainly that's the number that is being eligible to go into the workforce. Yeah.
So how does the university, like I asked earlier, you know, do we guarantee placements? And you mentioned the Alaska Teacher Placement Program, and I would like to hear more about that, because it would seem like the university would be very much trying to get these students into these empty teaching positions.
Through the chair, Representative Story, absolutely, the university, it's in their interest, and they do everything they can to support it, including supporting the Alaska Teacher Placement. Alaska Teacher Placement is a service for K-12. The K-12 districts support it with fees, but the university also supports it with hard dollars. It's a clearinghouse where districts can post their vacancies and teachers can post their resumes for consideration for hire. And so that's the service that universities perform from late 80s or mid-80s, so it's been a long time. So it's doing that as well.
And what I wondered about Alaska Teacher Placement, are they doing surveys of why students aren't following through? Or, and I know you said you want to be looking at that more too, but it would be good information to have.
Yeah, that's through the chair, Representative Story. That's our function to do that, okay. And we need to figure that out. And it does vary. It'd be wrong to say that there's going to be a single answer for why people are not choosing to go to work, because it's complicated. Like I said, people do choose to leave the state and go to work out of the state as a teacher, so that exists as well. But we will be looking more closely at that and figuring everything we can do to help get their feet wet, so to speak, with that first job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. My future brother-in-law is one of those very people who did the one-year master's internship practicum and has not gone directly into teaching. He's looking at going into future years now, but many, many different anecdotes about that, so you are correct. Before we came down as an interior delegation, we met with President Johnson, and he had described at that time, before the February 13th budget came out, that they were looking for a $3.1 million increase in their budget for increased nursing and teacher recruitment into the School of Education. That changed, obviously, when we got down here to session, and we never got to hear what that plan was going to be for that increased dollar amount and to be used. Can you please go into some ideas and some programs and possibilities of how that money would have worked within the College of Education and how that, what those plans were at that time for increased teacher retention with increased funding?
Yeah, I didn't see the specificity of the budget ask. I do know that it was going to be expanding Educators Rising, and Senator Hoffman's amendment with the intent language is good, but it doesn't offer new money for that purpose with Educators Rising, so mm-hmm. that was good. So I think it was to increase that program, certainly to support teachers going into rural Alaska. The recruitment of Alaskan Native teachers is crucial for us. We spend a lot of time and effort trying to help Alaskan Natives because we know the retention rate of Alaskan Natives, if they're working in their home region, is really high. I would be going with that. And then to support the program activity with regard to expansion. So.
Thank you. A follow-up?
Yes, please.
In the narrative, that describes the School of Education working with Alaska Native regional corporations and nonprofits. Can you talk some about that outreach that the School of Education is doing in that partnership to try to work with those regional nonprofits and corporations to expand?
You bet. And through the chair, Representative Hopkins, Alaska Native corporations all have a scholarship component or an education support component. So I've been working with them to dedicate more of their money to supporting future teachers, and they've never indicated whether they will or not. But I would like to see, or we're suggesting that they dedicate a portion of their scholarship funds only for teachers, for those people. So that's one of the outreaches that we have there. To the nonprofits, it's the time, the experiences, the internship experiences that we have with our future teachers to them. But the support of future teachers by that scholarship funds from the Alaska Native Corporations, we hope they can recognize the value, the importance of the teaching profession to their region, and in turn put it at the very top of their list for what they're doing with scholarship support. So I've been working to try and make that happen.
How's that going so far?
I've had good reception to that, but I've not heard the outcome of that. I did my pitch.
Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Dr. Atwater. It's been an interesting presentation. I recall the Board of Regents adopting a goal to, I believe it was by the year 2025, that 90% of the teachers hired each year would be UA grads. Are you the main one charged with that? Has that goal been adjusted? Is it being discussed to be adjusted because of what's happened at UAA, or are you still on track for that? And what does it look like? Are we going to reach that?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, whether we're on track for that, that's a stretch goal, certainly. As you saw from the slides, we're in the low 40s in terms of reaching that. There is discussion that we may want to rethink the goal, and that's primarily based on the fact that the employment of teachers is not a university function. Our goal is to prepare teachers, and the goal measures the function of the K-12 for hiring the teachers. So I think there is some consideration that it makes sense to, instead of use that as a metric, to instead use how many are you preparing as your metric. I know the president will be reviewing that in the coming week, I believe, in terms of whether that continues to make sense, but currently that goal still does exist. And in terms of how are we meeting it by 2025, we have a lot of work to do to get there. Yeah.
Thank you. Any further comments, questions? It's been a very interesting, a fine presentation. I appreciate it. You have your job cut out for you, Dr. Atwater. I'm glad you're there. So we need to talk as, I guess, the co-chairs and figure out what we're going to be doing here. I do believe that we need to hear from, during this interim, we need to hear from the president of the university, or at least the Board of Regents, on a couple of issues. First on this, 90% by 2025, that's a very important issue, but also the entire issue of the School of Education, where it's going, as well as what's happening with the University of Alaska Anchorage on accreditation. So really important issue. So if that's okay with we'll try and find a time we can meet with the university and try to get an answer to some of those questions. Very good. Well, thank you all very much. I appreciate everyone's comments. And with that,
1 second.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Dean Atwater. I really appreciate your presentation. The House Education Committee's next meeting is Wednesday, May 8th at 8 a.m. here in this room, so we can hear House Bill 136, Public Schools, Social and Emotional Learning, and House Bill 109, Military Children's School Residency Waiver. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. If there's nothing further to come before us, we are adjourned.